Hey, you know how Black Friday sales are the best savings of the year? Well, what if we told you Wayfair's bringing Black Friday to July? That's right. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is Black Friday in July. And it's on its way. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Snag outdoor furniture and decor at up to 60% off. Get area rugs for every room at up to 80% off. And refresh your sleep space with up to 60% off bedroom furniture. Plus, way more doorbuster deals on top products and 24-hour surprise flash deals. Oh, and did we mention free shipping on everything? Everything. These are Wayfair's lowest prices of the summer and the best time to make your home even more you. But it only lasts 5 days, so don't miss out. Mark your calendars, then head to Wayfair for up to 80% off Wayfair's biggest sale of the summer. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale, July 24th through 28th, only at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Buckle up. Here we go. We are about to dive into opening statements in the trial of Karen Reed. Of course, this is not live, so you're watching it a bit after it actually took place. If you're at work, I get it. So I'm going to be watching this for the same time with you. And as we're recording this, we're really not that far behind, really just a handful of minutes, but we're going to be going through this with you so we can react with you. I want to hear your comments. If you're watching us on YouTube in the comment section, please leave them. And if you're listening to the podcast, thank you. You will be able to get a full courtroom audio every single day from us on this case. So you can sit there and listen wherever you may be to this case. Be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you are watching or listening to us so you don't miss any of that coverage. In addition to the courtroom coverage here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast, we have a crew of experts that are going to be evaluating this case throughout the week, throughout the development, and they span the range of opinion. We don't just sit here and go, well, we're only this, we're only that, because honestly, reality and truth is usually somewhere in the middle, as I feel it is on this case. Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent with us throughout the week to help break this down, lover or hater, she is here on the opposite end of that. Bob Motta, defense attorney, expressing his opinions as well. And you know what? I'm friends with both of them. I can do that. I can disagree. I can agree. We can all be friends. It doesn't have to be the end of the world. They're both great people, great contributors. Whatever you think of their opinions, good human beings. And going on with that, we have Eric Faddis, defense attorney. He will be with us as well. Retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Drake, also with us throughout the week for commentary, as well as psychotherapist Siobhan Scott. So if you don't want to miss any of the insights into the case from our wide variety and spectrum of individuals who are here to help bring it to us, please, like I said, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts, or if you're watching this on YouTube right now, you're in for a good balanced look at this case as we dig in to it. And if you just want to follow the audio of this case and these interviews alone and no other case, we have a podcast channel for that. It is simply called The Trial of Karen Reed, and you'll find it wherever you get podcasts. It's the one that's been around for a long time and has like thousands of episodes in it. Then you'll know which one it is, because we cover the hell out of this. Okay, let's jump into it. This is the beginning of the day, and Judge Beverly Cannoni making reference to what's going on here with this case and some motions that came in over the weekend. Let's jump right into the coverage, and we'll comment as needed. Here we go. The trial of Karen Reed, part two. It's officially beginning right now.
Nobody said anything to Mr. Clark about needing to see me, but I received four motions over this weekend that I assume we need to at least talk about briefly. Commonwealth's motion regarding defense opening statement. I think the first two motions we can do quickly. I'm not issuing an order. Mr. Brennan, the defense knows, third-party culprit, will not be in the opening. If you think that their opening goes beyond it, you can object. Defendant's opposition to the Commonwealth's request for use of independent readers, because there's an objection, the defendant's motion's allowed. So you will not have an independent reader. Is it fair to say that the third and fourth motions Commonwealth motion to enforce compliance with court's April 16th ACCA discovery order and the Commonwealth's motion to preclude new expert testimony or alternatively to continue the trial date, that those motions will take a little bit of time, Mr. Brennan?
I don't think I'll be long in my argument.
I think that I need more information on one of them, and I think we'll do that at the end of the trial. At the end of today, we'll hear both these motions. Mr. Jackson, I did see that a list of text messages, 100 or so, is in your response to my order on Friday. Did you provide the text messages themselves?
No.
All right. In light of that and the fact that we don't have time, the juror has been waiting for some as many as 3 weeks now, I'm going to prohibit you from mentioning ACCA in your opening statement.
They don't like that.
And then we'll deal with this
all
later
of Reed's
today.
Attorneys are
I ordered
shaking
those
their heads.
Text messages and they weren't delivered. So we're going to be bringing the jury in. I'll be in recess for 5 minutes.
I heard on that, I think the court respectfully may be factually incorrect on a key assumption of what Your Honor is ruling.
5 minutes, Mr. Lessie.
Mr. Jackson couldn't give me the facts. I would like to give the law back.
That's more than 5 minutes. I'll see you at sidebar. Come up here.
So we don't exactly at this moment know why they did not deliver those 100 text messages regarding ARCA to the judge. What does all of that mean? ARCA is the accident reconstruction firm that in the previous trial was originally hired by the government to do an independent review of the scene itself, which there's nothing wrong with that. It was evidence and information that then both sides had free access to use. It was unbiased. Where issues of bias came in to this was after they provided their information to the government, the defense of Karen Reed hired them, and did not disclose that to court. So the information presented by ARCA in the first trial was essentially been viewed by the jury as unbiased material from ARCA, when in fact it was not. It was bought and paid for by the defense of Karen Reed. Now, expert witness is supposed to provide unbiased testimony regardless. And I'm not saying that ARCA did not do that, but if you don't disclose your receipts, you don't disclose who you're paying, you don't disclose who's, you know, now working for you, that can create the presumption or the look, if you will, of possible bias in this. And that was brought up earlier this year by the judge, Judge Cannone, saying that that you're on thin ice, basically, almost coming very close to firing or kicking some of her attorneys or one of her attorneys off of the case. But in the interest of Karen Reed and proceeding with this trial, it'd be very difficult to remove her defense. And she, as anyone does, deserves a fair defense. The judge decided to let everyone stay in this case. So they're at sidebar right now. We're not going to find anything out about what's going on at that sidebar until this gets underway. And what eventually happens here is sidebar ends and the jury, they go to a brief recess and the jury is going to come back in. And with that, I'm going to move the timeline and we'll begin opening statements and see what else Judge Beverly has to say as they come back from that brief recess. Let's pick up from there. In the courtroom today in the trial of Karen Reed part 2. Please leave your comments in the comment section. We would love to hear them. And here we go.
2282 CR 117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Can I have counsel identify themselves for the record?
Morning, Your Honor. Adam Lally for the Commonwealth.
Morning, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Your Honor. Hank Brennan for the Commonwealth.
Morning, Mr. Brennan.
Morning, Your Honor. Alan Jackson on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Elizabeth Little also on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Ms. Little.
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Lessie on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Lessie.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Unetti for Karen Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Unetti. Good morning, Ms. Reed. Good morning, jurors. So I have three questions I have to ask you because I haven't seen many of you for a long time. And we do appreciate that you are all here, ready, willing, and able to get started early. We sometimes have to deal with a few things before bringing you in, but we do appreciate your patience. So those questions are, were you all able to follow the instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we last saw you? Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we last met? Everyone said no or shook their heads. Thank you very much.
Jurors, can I have each of you stand and raise your right hands, please? Do each of you solemnly swear you shall well and truly try the issue between the Commonwealth and the defendant according to your evidence and according to the law, so help you God?
Yes.
Thank you. You can have a seat.
All right, jurors.
Jurors, hearken to these indictments. Karen Reed of Mansfield in the county of Bristol, on or about January 29, 2022, at Canton in the county of Norfolk, did assault and beat John O'Keefe with intent to murder such person, and by such assault and battery did kill and murder the said John O'Keefe, and is guilty of murder in the second degree and not in the first degree in violation of Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 265, Section 1. 002, Karen Reed of Mansfield in the county of Bristol, on or about January 29, 2022, at Canton in the county of Norfolk, did operate a motor vehicle upon a way as defined in General Law, Chapter 90, Section 1, or in a place to which the public has a right of access, or upon a way or in a place to which members of the public have access as invitees or licensees, with a percentage by weight of alcohol in her blood of 8/100 or greater, or while under the influence of intoxicating liquor, and did so operate said motor vehicle so the lives and safety of the public might be endangered, and by such wanton and reckless conduct so described did cause the death of another person, to wit, John O'Keefe, in violation of General Law, Chapter 265, Section 13 and a half. 003, Karen Reed of Mansfield in the county of Bristol, on or about January 29, 2022, at Canton in the county of Norfolk, did operate a motor vehicle upon a way or in a place to which the public has a right of access, or upon a way or in a place to which members of the public have access as invitees or licensees, and without stopping and making known her name, residence, and registration number of her motor vehicle, to go away to avoid prosecution or evade apprehension after knowingly colliding with or otherwise causing injury to John O'Keefe, such injuries having resulted in the death of said person in violation of General Law, Chapter 90, Section 24, Subsection 2, Subsection A and a half, Subsection 2. To these indictments, the defendant has pled that she is not guilty and for trial has put herself upon the country which country you are, and you are sworn to try the issue. If she is guilty, you are to say so. If she is not guilty, you say so and no more. Jurors, hearken to the evidence.
All right, thank you. All right, members of the jury, I'm about to make some preliminary remarks to you to acquaint you with some of the legal principles, procedure, and terminology that you may inquire during the course of this trial. These comments are not intended to be a substitute for the more detailed instructions on the law that I'll give you at the conclusion of the case. So you'll remember that this is a trial of a criminal case. Ms. Reed is charged with second-degree murder. She's also charged with manslaughter while operating under the influence and leaving the scene after causing personal injury or death, the indictments that Mr. McDermott just read to you. I'll describe the law in detail at the end of the case and the elements of these charges, but briefly, murder is the unlawful killing of a human being. In order to prove Ms. Reed guilty of second-degree murder, the Commonwealth must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she committed an unlawful killing and that it was done with malice. In comparison, manslaughter while operating under the influence is an unintentional, unlawful killing caused by wanton or reckless conduct while under the influence of intoxicating liquor. And leaving the scene of an accident after causing personal injury or death requires the Commonwealth to prove that Ms. Reed knowingly collided with John O'Keefe, that she caused him injury or death, and then she fled the scene. These terms and the elements of the crimes will be explained to you in detail at the end of the case before you begin your deliberations. Now, please remember that Ms. Reed starts this trial presumed to be innocent. The fact that she was arrested or that she was indicted is not proof of anything. An indictment is just a piece of paper. It just makes an accusation. It is merely a formal manner of accusing a person of a crime and bringing that person to trial in the Superior Court. But it is only the jury, in other words, you folks, who can decide whether the prosecution has proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. If the Commonwealth does not do that, then the presumption of innocence alone requires you to find the defendant not guilty. The law never requires a defendant to prove her innocence, to produce any evidence whatsoever, or to do anything other than attend the trial. This presumption of innocence remains with the defendant until you, the jury, make your determination after listening and considering all the evidence. Now, what is proof beyond a reasonable doubt? The term is often used and probably pretty well understood, though it is not easily defined. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all possible doubt, for everything in the lives of human beings is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. A charge is proved beyond a reasonable doubt if, after you have compared and considered all the evidence, you have in your minds an abiding conviction to a moral certainty that the charge is true. When we refer to moral certainty, we mean the highest degree of certainty possible in matters relating to human affairs, based solely on the evidence that has been put before you in this case. I have told you that every person is presumed to be innocent until he or she is proved guilty, and that the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. If you evaluate all the evidence and you still have a reasonable doubt remaining, the defendant is entitled to the benefit of that doubt and must be acquitted. It is not enough for the Commonwealth to establish a probability, even a strong probability, that the defendant is more likely to be guilty than not guilty. That is not enough. Instead, the evidence must convince you of the defendant's guilt to a reasonable and moral certainty, a certainty that convinces your understanding and satisfies your reason and judgment as jurors who are sworn to act conscientiously on the evidence. This is what we mean by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, our system of justice depends on judges like me and jurors like you being able and willing to make careful and fair decisions. All people deserve fair and equal treatment in our system of justice, regardless of their race, national origin, religion, age, ability, gender, sexual orientation, education, income level, or any other personal characteristic. You have agreed to be fair, and I am sure that you want to be fair, but that is not always easy. One difficulty comes from our own built-in expectations and assumptions. They exist even if we're not aware of them and even if we believe we do not have them. Some of you may have heard this called implicit bias, and that's what I'm talking about. Of course, we judges have the same problem as everyone else, so let me share a few strategies that we have found useful. First, slow down. Do not rush to a decision. Hasty decisions are more likely to reflect stereotypes or hidden biases. Second, keep an open mind. Avoid drawing conclusions until the end of the case when you and your fellow jurors deliberate. Remember that when you deliberate, you will have all the evidence and all the time you need to make a careful decision. So there truly is no need to stop making up your mind before them. Third, you should listen closely to all the witnesses. That is the best way to ensure that you decide this case based on the evidence and the law instead of upon unsupported assumptions. Fourth, as you listen to the testimony about the people involved in this case, please consider them as individuals rather than as members of a particular group. And finally, I might ask myself, would I view the evidence differently if the people were from different groups, such as different racial, ethnic, or gender identity groups? At the end of the case, I will remind you of these strategies and ask you to focus on the evidence instead of any unsupported assumptions you may have. All we ask is that you, individually and as a group, do your best to resolve this case based upon the evidence and the law, without sympathy, bias, or prejudice, to the best of your ability as human beings. Now, when I finish these initial instructions, the Commonwealth, Mr. Brennan, will make his opening statement. Then Ms. Reed's lawyer, Mr. Jackson, can choose to make an opening statement or not, because again, remember, the defendant has no burden of proof and doesn't have to prove anything. Her lawyer does not need to make an opening statement. An opening statement is a summary of what the lawyer expects the evidence at trial will be. It is intended simply to introduce the main issues in this case to you. Next, the prosecution will introduce evidence in support of the charges in the indictments. After that, the defendant may present evidence on her behalf if she wishes to do so, but she is not obliged to do so. Remember, the burden of proof is always on the Commonwealth to prove that the defendant is guilty. The law does not require any defendant to prove her innocence or to produce any evidence at all. After all the evidence, each side will have an opportunity to offer you closing arguments about what conclusions you might draw from the evidence. Like the opening statements, the closing arguments are not evidence. They're merely intended to help you understand the respective contentions of the parties. Finally, after all the evidence and the lawyer's arguments, I will instruct you in detail on the principles of law which you are to apply in your deliberations when you retire to consider your verdict. Your verdict must be unanimous. Let me speak briefly about our respective roles in this case. As the judge, my responsibility is to see that this case is tried orderly, fairly, and efficiently. It's also my instruction to decide any questions of law that come up during the trial and to instruct you about the law that applies to this case. It is your duty to accept the law as I state it to you, whether you agree with it or not. Your function, you folks are the most important people in the courtroom. Your function is to determine the facts. You are the sole and exclusive judges of the facts. You alone determine what evidence to believe, how important any evidence is that you do believe, and what conclusions all the believable evidence leads you to. You will have to consider and weigh the testimony of all the witnesses who will appear before you, and you alone will determine whether to believe any witness and the extent to which you believe any witness. You can believe all of what a witness says, some of it, or none of it. It's entirely up to you. It is part of your responsibility to resolve any conflicts in testimony that may arise during the course of the trial and to determine where the truth lies. Ultimately, you must determine whether or not the Commonwealth has proved the charges beyond a reasonable doubt. The lawyers have their own important role in this trial. They are, of course, advocates. Their job is to bring to your attention the evidence and arguments that best support their position. They may also object to evidence offered by the other side that may not be admissible under our rules of evidence. Similarly, we may engage in sidebar conferences out of your hearing. These sidebar conferences are not intended to keep secrets from you, but to allow the lawyers a little more time to argue their points so that I may rule on what you may consider as evidence. If I agree with an objection to a question, the term I will use is sustained. You are to disregard that question, and you're not to speculate as to what the answer might have been. In the same way, you're to disregard any evidence that I tell you is stricken from the record. If I reject or overrule an objection, I'll permit the witness to answer. This happens a lot. You'll find this during the course of the trial. If I let the witness answer the question, but you're not allowed to give the answer any more weight than you would have no objection had been made. Please do not hold it against the lawyers if they make an objection. That's the part of the important part of the lawyer's job. The lawyers have to let me know when there is a potential issue about the admissibility of certain evidence under our law. You must decide this case solely on the evidence presented in this courtroom. This will include the sworn testimony of witnesses and may also include any exhibits that are admitted into evidence, any facts that I tell you have been agreed to by both sides, and any facts that I indicate to you may be taken as a matter of common knowledge. Questions to witnesses, no matter how artfully phrased, are not evidence. Only the answers which you receive from the witnesses who are testifying under oath are evidence. So, if a witness is asked, isn't it true that after you learned that your uncle left you money in his will, you poisoned him? And the witness's answer is no. Based solely on that question and answer, there is no evidence that the witness has an uncle, that the uncle had a will, that the uncle left the witness money, that the witness knew that he did, or that the witness poisoned him. It is not evidence. My instructions to you and any other comments I may make, the lawyer's openings and closing arguments, and any comments they may make are not evidence. I will emphasize this point because it's crucial to your understanding of your role. If the lawyers or I make any comments during the trial, those comments are not evidence, and your verdict must be based only on the evidence. In Massachusetts, lawyers are not allowed to make comments other than during opening statements and closing arguments. They are permitted only to ask questions, but they cannot comment on the witness's answer. If a lawyer comments, you are to disregard it. In this way, communication in the courtroom is not like everyday conversation. If a lawyer seems to agree or disagree with an answer, or if a lawyer expresses confusion or any other reaction or emotion, you are to give no weight to what that lawyer does. In the interaction between a lawyer and a witness, you may consider only the witness's testimony as evidence. In a similar way, any comment I make is not evidence. But of course, you can't disregard what I say when I provide you with instruction or direction. Remember, however, I'm the only one who can instruct you or direct you in any way. Finally, on this topic, if one of the lawyers or I refer to some part of the evidence and that does not coincide with your own recollection, it is your collective recollection which you are to follow in your deliberations. Now, in this case, I anticipate that we will go by bus to an area that you'll hear about during the trial. You may consider as evidence anything that you observe about the layout of the area, including the scene of the alleged crime when we do go there. I will give you further instructions prior to our leaving for the view. Now, in this case, I'm going to allow you to take notes. Any jurors who wish to take notes during the course of the trial, except during opening statements and closing arguments, because remember, those aren't evidence. If you wish to take notes, you may do so once the evidence begins. Notebooks and pencils will be provided to you. The notebooks will be collected each day, and they'll be locked up, and they will remain confidential, and they're destroyed at the end of the trial. Nobody sees them. You're not required to take notes. The choice is entirely up to you. Some jurors may feel that notes are helpful, particularly if the case involves many witnesses or complicated issues. Notes also can help you remember specific testimony or evidence, such as times, places, dates, names, relationships, events, distances, things like that. Other jurors may feel that note-taking is a distraction and may interfere with hearing and evaluating the evidence. If you do take notes, I suggest you keep them brief. They are not and cannot be considered official transcripts of the trial testimony. However, bear in mind that although the court reporter is recording everything that transpires here, we do not have the capability of providing you with a transcript of the testimony at the conclusion of the trial. So you'll have to rely on your own memories of the testimony, perhaps supplemented by your notes. Regardless of whether or not you take notes, please remember that how a witness testifies may be just as important as what he or she says. Therefore, your observations of the witness's appearance and demeanor on the witness stand may play an important part in your assessment of his or her credibility. Do not let note-taking distract from an appreciation of all the evidence. If you have any trouble hearing or seeing during the trial, please raise your hand or let a court officer know and we'll make any necessary adjustments. We generally take a morning recess at around 11 o'clock or so, but if you need a break at any other time, please raise your hand and let a court officer know. We'll take a break. If you need to communicate with me during the trial, and I'm not suggesting for a minute that you need to, but if you do, please speak with the court officer or give the court officer a note to bring to me. Now, I'm going to address the issue of public interest in this case again and the duty of this court and this jury to adhere to the rule of law because it is so very important. John Adams famously said that we are a government of laws, not of men, and that the law must be deaf as an adder to the clamoring of the public. He meant that while public opinion about a given subject may ebb and flow, the law must be steady, reliable, and even-handed. We know that on the subject of this case, there are people advocating for one outcome or another with great intensity, but unbound by any oath or even any inclination to follow the actual evidence. The law works in a different way, and the difference is crucial to our system of justice. This jury, selected for this trial, will hear and judge the evidence. You will decide what the facts are. Where the evidence is contested, you will determine where the truth lies. Ultimately, this jury will decide whether the Commonwealth has carried its burden of proving that the defendant is guilty of any crime, beyond a reasonable doubt. People outside of this building have rights, and we know that they have voices, but this trial will be decided by you, an independent jury, free from outside interference, based only upon the evidence presented in this courtroom and the law. This is the only way to ensure that every person who comes before the court receives a fair trial. It is just that simple and that important. So while public comment will likely continue, you must ignore it so that the rule of law will be upheld. Which leads me to the fact that it is very important that during this trial, until you deliberate, you must not discuss this case with anyone. This includes your family and friends and even your fellow jurors. Nor should you allow anyone to communicate with you about any specific aspect or any aspect of this case. You must not conduct any independent research about this case, the matters in this case, and the individuals involved in this case. In other words, you must not consult the internet or do anything else to try and find out information from any source outside the confines in this courtroom. Please be very careful with your social media use. Please do not use X or Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Reddit. Though you may never have seen anything about this case before on your social media feed, you cannot control what may pop up. You should also remember that use of these platforms can be public and traceable, and any searches undertaken or information received by you can and likely will be discovered. So please be extremely cautious. If you inadvertently see something about this case, please disregard it and let us know. As best as you recognize them, please have no contact with any of the participants in this trial or anyone associated with either side, including the lawyers. Please do not visit any locations that may be mentioned during the trial. We'll go on a view, as I told you, and I'll discuss that with you before we go. Remember, you were instructed that you must not, and you assured us that you would not, read, watch, or listen to any account of any aspect of this case in any news media, social media, or from any other source. It is critical that you follow that instruction. Finally, please continue to keep an open mind. I know that you will try this case according to the oath that you've just taken as jurors. When you took that oath, you promised that you would well and truly try the issues between the Commonwealth and the defendant according to the evidence and the law. If you follow that oath, approach this case with an open mind and make your decisions fairly and without prejudice or bias or sympathy for anyone, then you will arrive at a true and just verdict, and that's all we ask of you. So it's now time for the opening statements. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Here we go.
At 6:04 a.m., on January 29, 2022, the alarm bell sounded in the Canton Fire Department. Firefighter paramedic Timothy Nuttall knew what that meant.
Mic him up.
Car skipped a beat, he raced to his equipment, and he picked up his bag, which was meticulous. There was a sign and a signal, and then there was a voice commanding that there was cardiac arrest. The most serious of calls for a firefighter paramedic, that means that a person's heart has stopped.
Well, as usual in a court case, their mics suck.
He didn't know where it was. He took his bag. He had just gotten to the station, and he rushed to the ambulance. He was one of the most senior paramedics that morning. Another paramedic, Anthony Flamatti, would be running this mission. He jumped in the back of the ambulance, the door shut, and they headed off to 34th Fairview Road. As they drove, firefighter Nuttall could not see anything. He couldn't hear anything other than the engine of the fire of the ambulance. He could feel it sliding across the road. It was near blizzard conditions. He calmed himself. He steadied himself. This is what the firefighters and paramedics are trained to do, to focus. And he focused on his task. He looked around the back of the ambulance to make sure that all the tools were in place. The ambulance was meticulous as well. This was Anthony Flamatti's ambulance, and it was well stocked. He calmed himself and he thought about what was going to happen. What should he be looking for? What is his next steps? He played the scenarios through his mind, and eerie calm was above him. As the car pulled up the 34 Fairview, the ambulance, he stood at the back door, the doors open, and he stepped out into bedlam. He could hear a woman screaming and shrieking, the cold, hard air slapping on his face, and the wind, blizzard conditions swirling around him. You will hear him tell you how he trudged towards those screams in the darkness to snow. And when he got there, he saw three women surrounding a man lying, not moving, on the ground. He walked up to the man and he reached down and he tried to find any signs of life, pulse, anything. And he found nothing. And he got up and he walked over to the woman, and he walked over to that friend of Karen Reed, and he told her that he thinks that that man is gone. And then he heard the yell from Anthony Flamatti, the chief, and he said, come back, let's go, because you'll learn that in the cold, even if somebody's heart stops, even if they're presumed to have passed, sometimes you can still save a life. So you'll see on a dash cam video, you'll hear through testimony, he went back to that man who's John O'Keefe. He went back to him, and that crew, coordinated effort, they did everything they could to save his life. They got on their knees, they began CPR, and firefighter Nutter will explain, as he kneeled over John O'Keefe, he looked up, and the defendant approached him, and you'll see it on the video. Now, he wanted any information, because when you're trying to save someone, you want to know, are they on drugs, medication, do they have a heart condition? And he looked up at Miss Reed and he said, what happened? And you'll hear her words to firefighter Nuttall. She said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him. And it was at that time, with the words of the defendant, that she admitted what she had done that night, that she hit John O'Keefe. Now those words didn't mean anything to firefighter Nuttall. They weren't in context, they didn't reconcile with the injuries, it didn't help him in his treatment, so he ignored it. Now, firefighter Nuttall is not a police officer. He is not an investigator, he is not a detective. He's a first responder. And so he takes that information, it was useless to him, he continues to work on John O'Keefe trying to save his life. You'll see the team put him on a stretcher, and when they lift him from the ground, even though there is snow accumulating, underneath John O'Keefe is simply grass, hard, brown, frozen. And beneath his body lay his cell phone. They bring him to the ambulance, and while they're bringing him to the ambulance, you'll see on the videos that other first responders speak to the defendant. One first responder, Mr. Flamatti, she will say, I hit him, oh my God, I hit him. And then she was interviewed, or ask questions for background information, not a criminal investigation, just background to try to help John. And she was asked questions about his background, and during that conversation, you won't hear see the defendant with a person by the name of Jen McCabe and a firefighter McLaughlin. And she tells Fire McLaughlin, the third first responder, I hit him. They bring Mr. O'Keefe to Good Samaritan Hospital. And his body is cold. The doctors work feverishly. They treat him, trying to save him. They try to warm his core. And unfortunately, firefighter Nuttall's first instinct is accurate. John O'Keefe passes. So why are we here today? We are here today because John O'Keefe was killed by the actions and conduct of that defendant, Karen Reed. You will learn through this case, through facts, science, and data, you will learn that on January 29, 2022, when the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe were in front of 34 Fairview Road, all the way to the left side in a dark corner near a flagpole, you will learn that Mr. O'Keefe got out of the car. He got out and he stood by the side of the road after an argument the defendant. That argument, that anger fueled by heavy intoxication, You'll learn from the science and data as he stood by the side of the road, the defendant in her SUV drove away. She drove at least 35 feet away, arguably over. It had ended. But then she stopped. She stopped, she put the Lexus into neutral, and she waited for 2 minutes. And the facts and the science and data would tell you that despite the fact the argument was over, she then put the Lexus into reverse, put her foot on the gas pedal and began to press, not 25%, not 50%, up to 75% acceleration. There was a light dusting of snow, the Lexus tire spun backwards, she went backwards at least 70 feet, she clipped John O'Keefe, he fell backwards, hit his head, broke his skull, and there he lay at the corner of Fairview Road. On the ground, lying on top of his cell phone, alone. And then the defendant will later tell that when she left, he didn't look mortally wounded. Yet he was. And she simply drove away. Now, before I tell you about the data and the facts and the science, and I walk
through that, starting out with mortally wounded.
A little bit about John O'Keefe. John O'Keefe was a young man, a local kid, very well liked, loved. John O'Keefe is the son of Peggy O'Keefe, John O'Keefe Sr., and the brother of Paul O'Keefe. Grew up in Canton, worked hard, he became a police officer. But what you're going to learn, the fact that he worked for the Boston police officer, as a Boston police officer, was just a fraction of his life. It was a small, really unimportant part, because the biggest part of John O'Keefe is he was a family man. Not in the traditional sense. You see, John O'Keefe never had biological children. John O'Keefe was never married. But John O'Keefe had a sister, and she had two children. And when the children were 6 and 3 years old, his sister unfortunately died. And shortly after, his sister's husband died. And John O'Keefe was at home. He didn't sit by. Saw these two recently orphaned children, and he stepped in and he said he was going to raise them. So he put aside his career, he put aside his job, and he moved in with the children and raised them up. They were his home. They were his passion, his love. He was a new parent, successes, failures, like all parents. And he raised the children with the help of people in the community, with the help of his brother, with the help of his family. And they led a good life. Enter Karen Reed. Around COVID, the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe reacquainted, and they started a relationship. And you'll hear that even though the defendant had her own home, she was staying with Mr. O'Keefe a lot, 4, 5, 6 times a week. And to most of the world, it was a pretty good relationship. They spent time together, they did activities with each other together.
It's like we have a little break here in the feed.
They spent time together. They did activities with the children together. She helped with driving the children, feeding the children. It was a steady relationship until about the beginning of 2022. And then things began to unravel. There was tension. There was arguments. In fact, just a few days before this incident, you'll hear that Mr. O'Keefe asked her to leave. But she wouldn't. You're going to be able to read text messages of their conversation on January 28, 2022. You will see the tension and the unraveling of the relationship. You will read about the discord between the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe. You will see that when he would ignore her calls, they would become incessant. When he would try to push away, she would come closer. You will read those text messages and you will realize that this was the beginning of the end of this relationship. That night, they decided they would go out together. I want to tell you something about data and science before we get to that night. I mentioned that underneath John's body was a cell phone. A cell phone is an amazing piece of technology. It is like a computer. It carries extraordinary data. And when they found the cell phone, the only companion in John O'Keefe that night, they studied the cell phone, and there'll be some remarkable data that you will use in this case to find the truth. I want to mention three different things you will find in a cell phone that are critical to this case. The first is called location data. Waze, we've all heard of, Google Maps. Well, at some point that night, John put his Waze on, and Waze is like a breadcrumb that will show exactly where the phone goes second by second. It is the strongest, most accurate location data that you can have. And that night, John was using Waze. It also will have healthcare data. Healthcare data will show when somebody is moving. Sometimes it's qualified as steps, but it doesn't necessarily mean somebody's stepping, moving their arms, walking, turning. It doesn't show what direction or how far, but it shows movement of a person. Okay. And the third thing, remarkably, it will be an expert in this case, found the data file on the phone, and it tracks the temperature of the cell phone battery. That will be critical to your analysis in this case, the temperature of the cell phone battery. And so with that, I want to take you back to the timeline of that night. After the discord, both the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe decided they would meet at a bar called McCarthy's. Now, McCarthy's is a local bar, a blizzard is pending, and people are getting together in a celebratory mood. They go to McCarthy's and they see a video of McCarthy's. And you will watch both Mr. O'Keefe, friends, and the defendant drinking alcohol. And you will count 8 vodka drinks that the defendant drank. They arrive at 8:50, they stay till 9:45. She consumed at least 7 of those drinks in less than 2 hours. The last drink, you'll see when they leave the bar, she puts it under her jacket, and they walk out and they go to another bar to meet other friends called the Waterfall. They reach the Waterfall sometime around 10 p.m. And when they go into the Waterfall, you'll see a video. And when I said celebratory mood, you will see a group of friends of John O'Keefe, many who are friends with Karen through John, and you'll see them clapping and happy and joyous that they're there. You'll see many hugs between John O'Keefe and his friends and the defendant and many of the people there. And they spend some time together, they're drinking, and they all do a shot. That will be at least the 8th drink within 3 hours that you consume. You will see from the data, not just the cell phone data, but there's some other very important data, and the other piece of data that goes hand in glove with the cell phone is information on the defendant's Lexus vehicle chips. You might have heard of black box in an airplane, or there's some type of event that captures a small amount of time. Well, that was captured in the defendant's Lexus. That black box information with the cell phone data will tell you everything you need to know in this case. It will bring us step by step through the entire night to the death of Donald P. And so they leave the Waterfall Bar at 12:12, and you'll see that the ignition goes on to the defendant's Lexus. Both John O'Keefe and the defendant in the car, and they decide that they're going to go back to 34 Fairview Road, where we talked about earlier. They're going to go there for a get-together for one of the homeowner's sons who's having a birthday party. And so as they drive back, we'll be able to follow them, this location data. When they go back to Fairview, they don't know exactly where it is, and they get lost. And so John O'Keefe makes a phone call. Phone call with one of his friends, Jen McKay. And during that phone call, which the defendant listens to because she recounts it, and trying to get directions, Jen McKay tells John O'Keefe, it's near Bella's mom's house. You'll learn that Bella, or her mom, was somebody that John had dated before this week. And so as they make their way to Fairview, you will see there's a road that comes down like a loop and that leads to Fairview. They take a wrong turn on the loop, and then they do a 3-point turn in the driveway. You will see the exact precise driveway they turn into because some type of acceleration movement triggered that black box in the Lexus. And that's important because that's 7 minutes before the collision. And you'll see from the Waze exactly where the car was. You'll see from the black box, you bent the three-point turn in the driveway, and then every turn down the Fairview. But before they get there, at 12:23, a truck is coming the other way. And the witnesses in that truck will say they blink the lights. One of them saw a man and woman in the car. John had offended. And then they followed the Lexus because they were going to the same house. The truck stopped at the driveway, and the Lexus, the defendant's car, will appear because of the waves and be counted second for second, never stopped. It will go very slowly all the way to the end of the yard in the corner where there's a tree line and a flagpole. And they reached that location at 12:34:33. And they're in the car and they stay there. The truck waits, somebody in the house is coming out, the person goes back in the house and they're there for about 5 minutes. We're now down to 2 minutes before the collision. The truck leaves, and now it's just the defendant and John. And while they're waiting outside at 12:27, John gets a text from Devin Cave, park behind us. Driveway. 12:29, text again, are you coming in? You'll hear that Jim McCabe and others look out the window and see the defendant's Lexus in front of the flagpole at the far end. It's snowy, it's dark, it's windy, they're waiting. You will know that John O'Keefe was in that car, that Lexus, and didn't move because his healthcare data is not moving. It's not moving until 12:31. At 12:31:56, he begins to move. He will have 20 seconds before he falls. 20 seconds. He gets out of the car, the Lexus. And in that 20 seconds, you'll hear that user initiated. He looks at the phone, at the text message from Jen McCabe. It is now 12:32:09. He closes the phone for the last time. It will be the last time he uses that phone. From the waterfall bar, you see that and at that time, 12:32:09, last user, he has 7 more seconds to move before he lies dormant the rest of the night. We'll also have the information from the defendant's Lexus black box. The clocks run differently than 30-second variance, but it's right in the heart of that time. And you will see the data at that time. Makes his last movements with the phone is when her car leaves 34 feet at least, bumps. And then shoots into reverse and the tire spinning right towards him. Right where he got out. You'll know they're arguing because the next morning she tells the firefighter, I'm sad because our last moments were fighting. She drives away. And they said, made later statements that when she left, he didn't look mortally wounded. He lied on the ground on top of his phone, light dusting of snow, snow now picking up. And he's just there. It's 12:37. Now, when he's in the car, before he gets to Fairview, the battery temperature of that phone is 77 degrees. 77 degrees in the warm car. Now that he's been outside the car for 5 minutes, drops to 70. She drives to his house. She makes a phone call at 12:33 after she's left there. She calls again at 12:36:33 and leaves a message you'll hear. And you will hear the anger and rage in her voice. She leaves a message. John, I fucking hate you. Pardon my language. You will hear the stimmering. And she leaves that message. He lies on the side of the road. He gets another text message that's unanswered. He's on the page. Where are you? 12:45. Battery temperature, 61 degrees. So, he gets almost 40 calls from the defendant that night. His phone rings, but he never answers. You'll hear from an expert that the light never initiates, the healthcare data never moves. Is John alone with his only companion, his phone? At 12:53, cell phone drops almost 60 degrees. 12:59, the defendant leaves another message on John's phone. Now, she hasn't spoken to anybody. Nobody has spoken to her. her message. You'll learn the message says, John, nobody knows where you are. And this is where the plot in the cover-up begins. The evidence will make clear that she knew he was there. But she did not call 911. She did not go back to him. She did not leave an anonymous tip. She left. The night wears on. It's now 107. Battery temperature 55 degrees. 114, she calls her mother. No answer. 114.53, battery temperature, 50 degrees. The defendant had healthcare data on her phone as well, and you'll hear that it stops around that time. And you later learn that she admits to falling asleep in fast mode. But then she wakes. 5 o'clock, she is frantic. She wakes up John's niece, and she is unintelligible. She's yelling, she's screaming, she asks for the niece to call Jen McCabe. She calls Jen McCabe, and you'll hear Jen McCabe recount. Out of deep sleep, she wakes up and she hears, Jen, 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 screaming Jen's name. John's dead. Hang up the phone. Jen McCabe calls down. And then what's going on? So when I left him at the waterfall, I left him at the waterfall. Jen calls back and says, he saw you up front. You did leave him at the waterfall. She hangs up. She then minutes later calls another person, Kerry Roberts, a friend of John O'Keefe. Someone who's not friends with the defendant, but they know because they helped raise the kids and they interacted. She had nothing to do with the night before. Wasn't at the bars, was home with her family. She calls her and says, I think John got hit by a plow. I think he's dead. Now, Kerry, with that information, calls 911. She calls hospitals. You can hear her voice. She's concerned. Okay. And then she gets another call from the defendant. And she tells the defendant, come to my house. I will help you look for him. And the defendant says, I was so drunk last night, I don't remember anything. Waiting for her to arrive, she learns she doesn't arrive. Instead, the defendant goes to Jen McCabe's house. Kerry Roberts, the other friend, then goes to Jen McCabe's house, pulls behind the car. When she does, she's on Bluetooth, and she can hear the defendant say, my taillight's broken, my taillight's broken. And she looks, and it's snow-packed in the right taillight. She can see a piece of the taillight missing. The defendant desperately wants to go to 34th Fairview Road, but Kerry Roberts takes over and says, we're going to go back to John's house. Maybe he's in the house and you didn't see him. So both cars, driven by Kerry Roberts and then Jen McCabe, with the defendant, go back to John O'Keefe's house. You'll see a Ring video where you see them go into the house and they look around and you'll hear about the woman, Jen and Kerry, enlisted into this task. Look for John O'Keefe. They cannot find him. And then when Kerry Roberts comes into a room, she sees, rather than looking, the defendant simply standing there, staring at the wall. At that point, the defendant insists they got to go back to Fairview Road. They decide to take one car. Kerry Roberts is taking charge. She's going to drive. They leave Miss Reed's Lexus and John Keith's driveway, and they drive back towards 34th Fairview Road. You'll hear it is blizzard-like conditions. It is dark. They can barely see a thing. And when they get close to the edge of 34th Fairview, you hear the defendant start to scream, there he is. Both women look, and they can't see anything. She starts kicking the door. The defendant's kicking the door. Let me out. Kerry Roberts stops the car and lets her out, and she sees the defendant run exactly to where John O'Keefe is in the darkness. That's where she left him. Kerry gets out of the car, starts to walk towards where the defendant is, and she sees the defendant lying on a body. She can't tell who it is because the face is still covered with snow. And she comes over and looks, and she wipes off the snow from John O'Keefe's face. She realizes one of her best friends in the world is John O'Keefe. And she starts to try to do first aid. They start to move him. And coincidentally, at 6:06, when they start to move him, the cold air hits that cell phone battery. It drops from 50 to 43 degrees. And they try. Jen McCabe calls 911. And that's when a police officer arrives, firefighter Nuttall and his crew. And when they lift him,
that cell phone battery that is shot down to 37 degrees. Carrie Roberts picks it up and puts it in her pocket, and it immediately starts to warm as she moves to help the educator show movement starts again. At that point, nobody knows what happened. Can't the police department come? You can see the police cars and cruisers. They're not sure. So they look in the area where John's body is and find a glass from the bar near his body. They find blood spots. They try to put the blood spots in plastic containers. They don't know what they're looking for at this point. There's no information. They don't believe or know that there's a crime. They just know that John O'Keefe somehow ended up here with the broken glass and the blood. And so that morning, see the work of the Camden Police Department to try to uncover a little bit around his body to see what they could find, which was very little. And then, Terry Roberts goes and picks up and goes to the news and they go to the hospital. They go to the Good Samaritan Hospital and Terry Roberts is walking and O'Keefe is going to go see her son with her husband. And as she walks down the hall, Karen Reed is also in the hospital. See, there were some reports of maybe she was upset or suicidal, so they sectioned her. They put her into evaluation to make sure she was safe. You'll hear Peg O'Keefe tell her she walked down the hall to go see her son. The defendant was screaming, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" As she walked by Karen, she stopped and she said, "Karen, what happened?" And you'll hear that Karen was excited. Dead, thoughts are excitement, becomes stoic, doesn't say a word. Peggy pays respects to her son, and then she has to go back home because she has to tell the children. Now, while she's out, the Canton Police Department sent an officer to the house to make sure the children are safe because they're alone if they're home. When the officer pulls in, he doesn't notice anything, but you'll see on the dash cam, you'll notice something. That taillight has a big missing piece to it. They can't find the children. Ultimately, Peggy comes home, a friend is taking them, and they bring the nephew home, and he is distraught. And then Peggy hears a knock on the door. It is the defendant and her father. They want to come in. They come in. No condolences. And they ask, "Go upstairs to John's room." And she's busy consoling her grandson. They go upstairs. They're upstairs for about 15 minutes. They come down. Quickly they leave. Now they got there from the defendant's father, his wife, and the father. That house. But when they leave, they take two cars. They take the Lexus with the broken taillight with them back to the defendant's father's house. And you will learn that when police start getting some of the information, they learn about the broken taillight, they learn information that she had told people that she had hit him. They went down to see her, and on their way down, they decided they would get a warrant to take the Lexus. When they get down to Dighton, where the car is, you'll hear from Trooper Buchanan, who took a look and you can see the missing taillight. They went in and spoke briefly to the defendant. They took the car, they brought it back to Canton. And so, what you'll learn from the forensic evidence that will help with the science and data is that not only was the cell phone left behind, but also around that area, broken taillight was littered around John O'Keefe's body. Littered around that area. When they got into the hospital, they noticed there was a shoe missing. As time went by, snow melted, they dug the excavation, they found the shoe on a little berm on the border between the street and the grass. You'll learn days later when they did a plant excavation, they found this path frozen to the ground. Ultimately, they would find over the course of 10 days that the snow melted almost all. Every piece of that broken taillight in that area. The hat, the sneaker, the glass. when the defendant left Mr. O'Keefe behind, took with her something of Mr. O'Keefe's, called Gray's evidence, to lure on the back of her Lexus around the taillight area, John's DNA, and stuck to the side, grasping one last piece of John O'Keefe's hair. Now, John O'Keefe fell backwards in his head after he was put by the car. And you're going to hear from a very renowned doctor, a neurosurgeon, who has treated thousands and thousands of head injuries. And the wound on the back of the head, when he fell backwards, on the crack of the skull, it's called a basal fracture, to create an injury called countercoup. After he was put by a car and fell backwards and hit his head on that hard rock ground, remember this. No, it's just a dusting at this point. The back of his brain hits the back of his skull and bounces up. When it bounces up, it leaves marks showing that impact. And this neurosurgeon will tell you, treated thousands of patients, that this injury, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is countercoup caused by falling backwards in your head. When the medical examiner for the state looked at it, they generally said blunt force trauma that head is undetermined. You're also going to hear from an active reconstruction, his name is Doug Welcher. He does not work for the state police or local police. He was hired to take a look at this case and the data. He will come in and explain to you exactly what I talked about, how the data from that black box coincides with the cell phone and the movements of the car, the moments before, during, and after the defendant struck. Now, just a few more things I want to share with you. There are three charges against the defendant in this case. The first one, second-degree murder. When most people hear murder, they instantly think shooting somebody, stabbing somebody, putting them to the liver of premeditation. I will instruct you on the law. I'm not going to trample that area, but I can tell you clearly, we are not going to try to prove that Karen Reed tried to kill John O'Keefe. We're not going to try to prove to you that she intended or wanted him dead. That's not second-degree murder. What we'll prove to you is she engaged in an intentional act, driving back at him at that speed, in the storm, in the darkness, knowing that he had just gotten out of her Lexus. She intended that act, which could cause the plane, the strong likelihood of death. That's what we'll prove to you, second-degree murder. Also, operating under the influence of alcohol, manslaughter, will prove to you that she drove her Lexus recklessly. She hit John O'Keefe, and because she hit him and he fell back, she caused his death. The third charge is being seen acting knowingly causing death. Again, she hit Mr. O'Keefe with a car. She knew he was injured. She left him behind. He died. That's a whole group. This case will come down to the science and the data. The science and the data, the cell phone, is the best of historians. It doesn't suffer from intoxication, it doesn't suffer from memory loss, it doesn't suffer from emotion, pride, or prejudice. It is facts, it is data. And that facts and data will lead you to the truth in this case. But after Ms. Reed was charged, she began what you'll learn is a campaign. A campaign to make public statements. 2020, Nightline, Fox 25, a documentary. And we've had an opportunity to get many of her statements in the footage, and we're going to show much of you. And her statements to you will confirm what you already know from the science and the data, what you will already conclude from the facts independent about what she did that night. Her words will simply confirm your judgment is sound. And you're going to hear from her own lips and many of her statements, her admissions to extraordinary intoxications, her admissions driving the Lexus, her admissions to being angry at John that night, and I dare say her admissions that she told like to play for you clip one. You're going to hear the personal statements that she made after she was charged.
This should be interesting.
I mean, I didn't think I hit him, but could I have clipped him? Could I have tagged him in the knee and incapacitated him? He didn't look mortally wounded as far as I could see, but could I have done something that knocked him out and in his in drunkenness and in the cold didn't come to again?
This would have been the moment you dropped him off at the party.
Yeah, thinking. Yeah, would have had to.
That's exactly what I said they'd show in opening, and they did.
Ladies and gentlemen, I simply ask you to follow the evidence, follow the science, follow the data. Ignore speculation, surmise, conjecture. Stay true to the evidence. It will lead you to the truth. That on January 29, 2022, a very intoxicated defendant was angry and arguing about the relationship with John O'Keefe. And after the fight was over, she left, but she brought the fight back to him in the form of her SUV. She clipped him, he fell backwards, he broke his head, and then this man who helped, a lifetime of help, was left at the corner of that yard, left to die with no help. The facts, the data, and the evidence will bring you the truth, and the defendant's own words confirm everything you've already seen.
Mr. Jackson.
All right, we're going to pause right there, and we're going to go back, and we will pick up in a second segment with the opening statements from Alan Jackson and the defense of Karen Reed. I did put headphones on there because the audio from the court is so poor. You would think with such a high-profile case, they would have a little bit of common sense on how to keep someone mic'd so they can be heard. I know the main thing is, in that courtroom, that is the priority. But for the love of God, there's a lot of people watching this. And for the interest of us having the right to watch it, which we do as American citizens, could we do a little better? Could somebody please figure out how to put a microphone on somebody, for the love of God? I mean, it's 2025. If your 8-year-old can do a better job at miking themselves for TikTok, I think court could handle that. But who am I? What's your thoughts of this thus far? It seems some of the big things that were being brought up in this case, that may be a little bit different than last time. The big thing that stood out to me, temperature of the cell phone. That's a new one. That's one I'm pretty damn sure was not brought up in the first case. The temperature of the cell phone is going to tell us a lot about the location of John O'Keefe. And they also supposedly have some more detailed cell data than they had the first time around about his movements, where that cell phone went. And of course, it will be contradicted and it will be questioned by their experts, who are probably going to say that that's not true. And then the jury's left to try and determine, okay, which expert is right, especially with neither of them having, you know, a anything in the game here. They're just supposed to be experts testifying about what the facts are, and facts should be black and white. But unfortunately, somehow we've turned facts into gray areas as well in this case. So those seem to be some of the most interesting pieces that I took away. What did you take away? Tell me in the comment section on YouTube. I would love to hear it. And if you're listening to the podcast, please check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, so you can join in the conversation there. There's going to be a lot of it over the next handful of days. Coming back next with the defense and their opening arguments in the trial of Karen Reed. My name is Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.